Well, I'll tell you, one thing we've got to report tonight, since it's Tuesday night, and one good thing about Tuesday night, it's a kind of, it's a sort of weekly soma, using the Aldous Huxley term there. I mean, most people, there's a buzzing sound between the ears. It's Monday, you know, we don't want to get into week business, but one thing we do must say, we have to say tonight, is we report with a great deal of pleasure that realism has returned to television. Return to television in the guise of baseball. Because I have said, I said it last season, I said it the season before last, and I will say it probably three seasons from now, that you can tell more about what's really happening to this fat-headed Hey, did they ever have a thing in your neighborhood when you were a kid called a Holloway sucker? Did you ever hear of a Holloway sucker? Well, is there anybody out there who ever heard of a Holloway sucker? Now, a Holloway sucker could be just any ordinary native who has come out of Holloway, Pennsylvania. But this is a Holloway sucker. It's a five-cent sucker. It's a big, long, caramel sucker. Is there anyone else out there who's had one? Oh, sure, for crying out loud. Look, my entire first half of my fourth grade year, I got terrible grades because my teeth were stuck together due to a Holloway sucker that I got hung on early in September. I got off to a bad start in the season. You could clamp your teeth together with them. Yeah, they were brown, and you could, and your teeth get stuck in there, and sometimes they were stuck until after Christmas. I know a kid that got a reputation for having great, absolutely impeccable manners. He used to say, Warren is a wonderful boy. He never talks and never says anything nasty to his mother. Of course, Warren had his molars stuck together ever since he was four. From one of these rotten Holloway suckers. Anyone ever had a Holloway? All right. Now, the reason I'm talking about Holloway suckers is because sometimes I have a feeling that our globe, the globe we're living on, is a gigantic Holloway sucker. Now, somewhere in some unexplored part of the globe, the stick is sticking out. And we haven't discovered the stick yet, but it won't do any, you know, it wouldn't make any difference. It's not a free stick anyway. It's just one of the ordinary sticks. But somewhere the stick is. And I can suspect where the stick is stuck. I'll let you think that one over for a while. It's your own rotten mind. But nevertheless, the earth is this gigantic Holloway sucker. Somebody had a Holloway sucker? All right, I'll put you on the thing. I think it could really make it today. There was another kind of a sucker, and this is not nostalgia, so don't immediately start saying, oh, yeah, do you remember the Juju babies? Oh, yeah, and do you remember the wax false teeth? Oh, my. And do you remember Jawbreakers, Fred? No. That was all rotten candy, and that's the reason why your liver is bad today. It was terrible. You wouldn't touch it if you had any. As a matter of fact, Peggy Fitzgerald the other day was crying and weeping about penny candy on her show. She got 17 pounds sent to her. She got sick when she looked at it. Didn't taste a bit of it. The mice are at it. The sweepers have been eating it. The fat cleaning ladies that come in have been eating it. Peggy has stayed 4 miles away from it. Peggy is strictly Le Pavillon. Anytime Peggy's going to have a lunch of Juju babies. Oh, boy. You know, the richer people get, the more they talk about their humble beginnings, and the less they want to return to them, believe me. It's just the way it works. But nevertheless, there was a kind of sucker. Yes, that's a good word. There was a kind of sucker that was shaped like a golf ball. And it had a golf ball tread. You know how the tread is? Like the little crisscross or the little waffle tread or the little dimple tread. It was like a golf ball. And you could get them in chocolate. You could get them in strawberry. Well, of course, you know that strawberry that comes with the suckers. It's just sort of a sweet, tingly taste, a rotten taste. You could get them in orange. And they were called golf ball suckers. Yeah, and I think that they were ahead of their time, you know. Nobody played golf in our neighborhood, you know. There was a little fist fighting going on, but hardly any golf. And today would be the time to bring in the golf ball suckers. All the kids are sitting out there watching golf, you know, it's a big deal. Did you ever hear of a golf ball sucker? All right, fine. Here we're getting back to the point now. This old fat Holloway sucker globe of ours is changing continually, you know, because the sun is melting it. And other things are happening. It's getting sticky. It's up to your knees now, the stickiness, all the rest of it. And it's changing so gradually that it's hard to tell. Now, if you were going to watch television and you were going to try to tell what's, you know, changing in the world, you could never get it by watching, say, Ben Casey. I mean, this is about as far from realism. This is roughly about as realistic as the average scene in The Wizard of Oz and The Emerald City. You remember? And probably the wizard said the last word about the usual realistic drama on TV. He just said, humbug. I remember that line. Very good line. Humbug. I am a humbug. I don't think Casey would say that, but I hope a critic or two will. But they don't, huh? They hardly ever do. They get confused because they use real scalpels on the show. Somehow, if you got a real scalpel, that makes the show real, in spite of the fact that the plot is strictly right out of about a 1934 Blue Book, Argosy, Batman mystery. Roughly, you know, that kind of thing. The plot is always, you know, Well, nevertheless, that doesn't matter. It's all fantasy on TV, except when baseball comes on. Then you get realism. You get guys scratching, and they're really scratching. You get guys spitting, and the camera always picks up the wrong things, but actually are the right things, and you're beginning to see what realism is about. And like today, you know, just a little unaccustomed realism. You have to sneak up on baseball broadcasts gradually, because over the winter we're used to a whole influx of reruns of Lucy, you know, and Phil Silver's shows and all this jazz, the Today Show and the Tonight Show and the Yesterday Show and the Tomorrow Show and the World Turns Show and all this jazz going on. It's very difficult to get back to realism. It shocks a lot of people to see Roger Maris scratching where Roger Maris always scratches right after they've thrown of an inside pitch. He's telling you right where it gets him. Well, I've always dug Maris for that. I'll never forget the fantastic scene I one time saw when Ted Williams stuck his head out of the dugout and told the world just what he thought of the world. In no uncertain terms, nobody in the Western Hemisphere misunderstood what he meant, and everyone silently agreed with him, and he was fined 500 simoleons. You will never get Ben Casey to do that. After the commercial, he'll look right at you and tell you what he thinks of it all, you know. Really? In no uncertain, almost Marcel Marceau meme terms. It was a wordless phrase that Ted used. However, it made the point. Everyone was promptly... It was like today, you see, Casey Stengel comes roaring out of the dugout after they have called a balk on this pitcher. Well, Stengel made Marcel Marceau appear to be an amateur. He was you should have seen the meme. He was going through, and he turns around, he walks, he goes back, you know, that funny walk he's got, he's... I do a great Casey Stengel walk, by the way, in case you're interested. That's the only thing I can do at parties. So Stengel goes stalking back to the dugout. He gets halfway back. He turns around and he looks out at his pitcher. His pitcher's out there, this guy with a big chew in his mouth, an ex-minor leaguer, you know. Actually, he's still a minor leaguer, but he's pitching with the Mets. So he's out there chewing his tobacco, sort of dumbly looking into what this umpire's done. So Stengel, but the guy looks over at Stengel. Stengel takes his hands and claps him over his stomach. He memes the one-second pause, which means put your mitts over your stomach, bend over, buck up and down three times, and let that clown behind the plate see that you're pausing, will you? You're not like this. None of you know what's going on. He spits, turns around, and into the dugout. What a moment. You know, I'm sitting out there, and right away I know the season is off to a start. It's going, you know? But this is not a show about baseball. It's a show about realism. So here's an example of realism striking out, lashing up, and again rearing up that fantastically ugly evil head. You can hear realism on its cloven hoofs, and its horns clattering against the scenery, waiting in the flats there. I got the TV set, see, and I switch over to see how the Yankees are going. I go like this. This is exactly what happened. I go clunk. And you hear Mel Allen saying, and there goes Bobby Richardson into the third base. Yes, he makes it. It's a stand-up triple for Bobby Richardson. Makes the score now 7-0. Then I go clunk. I switch back, and he says, strike three. Braulio has just struck out his fourth straight Met, and 27 consecutive Mets have now bit the dust. Makes the score now 4-0. In one bing-boom like that, I get the reality, the yin and yang of it all, you know? It just knows... So I'm sitting there, and the one thing that I did notice that must be reported on, for the benefit of those of you who are interested in our changing scene, this has nothing to do with baseball, but a little thing happened over the winter that finally hit and was displayed on television today for the first time. And there's been a hassle about it for a long, long time. I hope you know what it's been about. Now, again, I must stress that we're talking about something much bigger than baseball here. Since the major leagues were founded, actually the first major league was the National League, 1871, I believe, and the American League came into being, I believe, around 1900. When they formulated the universal rules for the major leagues around the turn of the century, they stipulated, without question, absolutely spelled it right out, they stipulated what the uniform regulations would be. That is, the uniforms, the players' suits, what they would wear. They said that the home team would wear whites, and whatever the trim would be their colors, if they so desired. The away team, or the road team, would wear gray, a uniform shade of gray, with, of course, their own color. If their colors are green, let's say, or if their colors are like the Mets, orange and blue, the trim can be orange and blue. They wear a blue cap with a little gold or an orange letter, or they can wear blue socks. But the point is, you got to wear white if you're home team. You wear gray if you're away. That is a rule. Now, there was a reason for this rule, you see. And the reason, of course, has to do with many things. It has to do with the game of baseball remaining a clear game. It's a pure game. It's as though stipulating by tradition and by custom the costumes that a bullfighter shall wear. He wears a specific costume, you see. The matador wears one kind of costume. The picador wears another. It has to do with tradition. But even more importantly, it has to do when a team comes out on the field. There is a uniformity. Now, it has nothing to do with conformity. It is uniformity. That the away team is gray, the home team is white. No matter where you go, it is a tradition and a standard. Well, this has always been maintained, and from time to time, guys have tried to change it for their own purposes, one way or the other. And only last winter was a promoter-type ball manager or ball owner, ball club owner, able to swing the deal quietly without saying anything. And so now the Kansas City Athletics, which are a notoriously rotten ball club. If you think the Mets are terrible, oy. Oh, boy. The Mets have one redeeming feature, and that is a kind of color. The Mets really do have a kind of color. There's no question about it. Whereas, on the other hand, a team like the Kansas City Athletics is not only a mediocrely bad team, they are almost totally lacking in color of any kind. It's just a ball club and not even a good one. So the owner of the team decided he was going to put a little razzle-dazzle into it instead of, get a couple of good hard-hitting outfielders and a couple of good left-handed pitchers. He's going to get some jazzy suits so nobody would really notice what's going on out there. So now this team has been able to come out on the field dressed in bright Kelly Green uniforms. Kelly Green with gold jerseys and gold hats. It's fantastic. Well, of course, they look exactly like a softball team. You know, you expect to see on the back Charlie's Bar and Grill, the Ace Restaurant, you know, on the back of them, you see. And what's even funnier, that the Kansas City Athletics not only look like a softball team, they play like a softball team, which kind of gives a little pizzazz to it, too, there, you know. That pitcher, I swear, was pitching underhand today to Bobby Richardson. But that's beside the point. Here they are out there. You see these poor clowns running around in their green and silver or gold uniforms. Now, this is going to lead to something. I guarantee you this. You see, once the barrier has been broken, every ball team that is bad will come out with its own suit, you see. So that I see in the near future the masked marvels. There will be a team that will wear solid silver capes when they come out, you see. And they'll have solid silver uniforms with black masks. and they will have silver hats with little black horns. And now, pitching for the Mask Marbles is Mask Marble number 7. Who is he? And then the music on the PA system will go boom, 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 boom. Well, I predict the next one you're going to see, the Philadelphia, for example, the Phils, if they have a bad season, next season will come out with the Blue Devils. And you'll see these guys dressed with these dark blue uniforms, and they'll have a big red devil on the back. And they'll have tight hats that come down around their ears, you know, with a little widow's peak comes down to the nose. And it'll have a little truncated bill sticking out in front of black, you see. And the red cap will come down around the back of the neck and have two little red horns. And now, pitching for the Blue Devils, Art Mahaffey, number 19. Wait and see. I'm predicting something that I know will come to pass. And you think that I'm making this jazz up. Wait. Wait and see. It all began, of course, when one of my favorite buffoons, O'Malley, proceeded to make out of baseball a traveling road tent show. And I would say within the next 5 years, baseball will be a traveling show kind of thing. It'll be hardly baseball anymore. It will be traveling around. A team will play like 2 or 3 years. It will be as if a road company of the Yankees is playing in Chicago for a while. And then a couple of months later, the next season, they will play out of Toronto. And then a few seasons after that, they will play out of San Diego. Oh, yeah. And for that couple of seasons, they'll call them the San Diego Seals. And they'll wear sealskin suits. And then they'll be the Tijuana Leopards. And they'll wear leopard skin suits. Yeah, I'm predicting this. And you think I'm being very, very, being very, no. It is in the cards. And you see each one of these little things happening, and you know, it's not baseball I'm talking about. It is America itself I'm discussing. What's the matter? Oh, I've done that long ago. You weren't even listening. It's America itself I'm discussing because, we're not concerned at all any longer with things that will have any, I suppose you might say, any intellectual interest at all. Now, I'm not trying to say baseball is intellectual. Let me tell you this. Baseball is about 1,000% more intellectual than pro football, at least. Speaking of no intellectual, this is WORAM and FM New York. He's been done it. But it's slowly beginning to happen. And everywhere you go, what was that great line here that was quoted here a couple of months back? Speaking of football now, as long as you're going to talk about football, a New Yorker columnist who usually writes about football, he writes about Ivy League football generally, was writing about a pro football game. And he says, I kept watching this pro football. It doesn't matter who it was. Don't keep answering my rhetorical questions. He was writing about pro football, see, and he says, I kept watching this pro football game, and he was describing a game between the Packers and the Lions. I kept watching this pro football game, and I was trying to figure out what it reminded me of. And I'm watching this thing for a while, and then all of a sudden it came to me. I knew what it reminded me of. We used to call it beanbag. That's what they were playing. Well, if you've ever seen pro football in the last couple of years, you know exactly what I mean. It's nothing but beanbag. They're throwing that ball around. You know, it's all. I go back and throw. They call it pass tag too in another in another league, but nevertheless, it's slowly beginning to change all the way down the line. And I'm not against change. I am against let's say debauchery, which is another thing entirely. Debasing. This is not necessarily change. Speaking of debasement, we have here, I got a letter from Marty Geisler of the Paper Book Gallery, and this arrived at the station yesterday, and I will read it to you exactly the way it reads. It says, Dear Gene, this week, and listen carefully because this is a very interesting letter, this week marks our 5th anniversary. To the general public, we are offering the entire record stock at 77 cents each. three for $2. But now listen, to your listeners alone, we would like to offer the same two-for-one, unadvertised, except on your show deal, two for 77 cents. Six for $2. You will get six LPs for $2. But he goes on to say, they must mention the show. It must be done. Two for 70. They are absolutely losing dough on this. He goes on in the next paragraph. He says, this is unquestionably the finest record offer in the world. These records list at $498 and $598, and many of them are wild collector's items, unobtainable anywhere else. This I can agree with. Absolutely a guarantee that's true. He says, this offer is good for 1 week only. Then we may possibly extend it for one more week until we notify you. But this is good for 1 week. See, he doesn't know if everybody rushes in and buys the records, forget it. So remember, you must identify yourself. This is 399 6th Avenue only. That's the Paper Book Gallery on 6th Avenue, just off 8th Street. 399 6th Avenue. Okay? That is wild. Six records for $2. But you have to identify yourself. Well, you know, getting on with this business of the fascinating change that's come about, I really do see the day. You know that they're building a stands. They're building a stadium now for baseball in Houston. Do you know that? That is going to be covered over entirely. It is going to be. It's going to have a big plastic dome over it, which will make baseball an indoor game, thereby destroying one of the great charms of baseball itself. It's an indoor game. Now, one of the things about baseball, of course, is the fact that baseball has to be played against varying types of weather. Nothing is more interesting than to see a curveball pitcher having problems because a wind has sprung up, or a pull hitter having his problems because suddenly the wind has shifted and now there is a 40-mile gale blowing right into his face. It changes, it gives all kinds of interesting colors to the game. All sorts of colors, all up and down the line, you know. And it adds immeasurably to the game. The fact that in the eighth inning a slight mist begins to fall. And this knuckleball pitcher suddenly has terrible troubles controlling his knuckleball. This is part of the game. And now we're building a stadium that has a big bubble over it, so we will remove that whole element. And I suspect the next thing we're going to have is indoor yacht races with dry water. You know, with electric fans that blow the wind, you know, so that the sails have uniform wind and they'll make a whole bit. This to me says so much about our world, much way beyond the Ben Casey show and way beyond the Phil Silver show. It tells about our terrible desire to control our environment and furthermore even control the things which by design are uncontrollable. What is supposed to be more imponderable than a game? The reason we have games is because of the possibility of the great numbers of imponderables that occur during a game. This is what makes any game exciting. But we want to control that. We're bothered by that fact, you see. We're bothered by the very creation that we created. Now, football, of course, is a prime example of that in the end. I suspect that we're going to wind up with football players who never get their uniforms dirty. As a matter of fact, many a quarterback is never touched during an entire four quarters of football today. You know that? Never touched. Never a hand laid on him. This is the way football is played today. Some football games are played today. The entire game is played, and not one carry is made. Nobody runs with the ball anymore. Not one carry is made. Oh, no. Now, if the guy has to run with the ball, it's because the play went. Somebody balled up on the play, and he had to run with it. But it's not designed to be done that way. I've seen football games where there was not one attempt made on a ground play. Well, I heard a guy, some nitwit, talking the other night, and this has really bugged me. He was talking about the fact that he is designing an indoor football stadium. And he says, well, I'll tell you why it's good. Now, all of us remember a few years ago, the Chicago Bears arrived to play for the World Championship of the Professional League against the Washington Giants. They were playing against the Redskins, rather, the Washington Redskins. And without any warning, a big snowstorm and a rainstorm sprang up, and the Chicago Bears took advantage of that by wearing sneakers. And the Redskins were not prepared, and the Chicago Bears ran away with the ball game 73-0. Now, in the indoor type of football I foresee, that sort of thing would be impossible. And he was saying it as though he was making a real point. Now, we'll not have any of these imponderables about weather. None of this stuff will ever enter it anymore. Well, part of a good football team or a good boxer or a good baseball team or a good politician or a good writer, for that matter, is taking advantage of and utilizing, observing, and molding to his own uses the environment in which he finds himself. This is what it means to write. This is what it means to do any sort of an activity that has those imponderables involved. And yet we are doing our damnedest, if I may use a vernacular phrase here. We are doing our most or our worst to completely take out of life that one element that makes life exciting, and that is the imponderability, the let's say, the possibility of total loss and the possibility of total victory. One of the dullest games, I don't know who watches this game. I can't understand. It must be only gamblers. One of the dullest games of all, and it used to be one of the most exciting games. To me today, one of the most dull games that we have is basketball. Talk about your profound bores. Oy, oy, oy. Primarily because basketball has lost the imponderable quality. You have a race of seven-footers, and every team scores now, particularly pro basketball. The scores are invariably 145 to 136. Who cares after the first 148 points, you know? How can you get excited over a basket? This is what's happening, of course, to baseball, since they have that little motor-propelled center there in the ball. And every 220 hitter is a potential home run hitter. This is part of the game, too, now, or part of the slow debasement of the game, till eventually we will have people who will... I say that within the next 5 years, you will see guys who will hit 100 home runs or more. I say that, yeah. Huh? Five what? I'd say within 5 years, you're going to see a guy hit 100 home runs. Oh, yeah. I say you will. Just wait and see. I predict this. It's a wild prediction, but I say that somebody will. An example of this kind of thing, of course, not to take anything away from Roger Maris, but Roger Maris is not Babe Ruth in any sense of the word. He's a good ball player. But Roger Maris, under ordinary circumstances, is roughly a 25 home run hitter. During ordinary baseball. Yes, he is, during conventional or classical baseball periods. The way I say, you have, of course, we could go into a long discussion of this. You have to look at Babe Ruth's record the year he hit 60 home runs. The next guy to Ruth was Gehrig, hit something like 45, something like that, and that was a fabulous amount of home runs. But below that, the next guy, all the way down the line, a great home run hitter, hit something like 23. And there was only one guy in the entire league who hit 45 home runs after Ruth. Whereas the year that that Roger hit 60 home runs, there must have been 15 guys hit 30 home runs and more. And quite a few guys, his own teammate hit 58, wasn't it 56, something like that, Mickey Mantle. So everybody was hitting home runs. So the home run no longer has any meaning. It's like baskets. So if a guy scores 67 baskets in one game, a basket no longer means much. I suppose this is all part of the general attitude. But it's an interesting thing. And to watch that today on television, these guys running around out there, I was reminded immediately when I saw the poor old Kansas City Athletics. I was reminded of a softball team, the Eastman Kodaks, something like that. You know, you can see them playing under the light. And to make it even more interesting, you know, their uniforms are this shiny stuff, this sateen stuff. Oh, yeah. Sure. And it really is sad. And apparently when they came out of their dugout, they came charging out, you know, and everybody's wearing the little thing on the back. It says Charlie's Blue Devils or whatever it is they had on the back. They came tearing out. And the whole Yankee team rose up to one man, you know, and they were blowing kisses at him as they went out. I had to cheer the Yankees for that, you know. And they go trotting out there. And it would have been, you know, of course, it would have been nice had they come up to their uniforms. But as it was, I was gratified to see that they played to the absolute level of the suits they were wearing, which was roughly like, I'd say Class D softball. It was pretty good, pretty fast game, but not much real hitting. And a lot of sloppy base running, but it was fun to watch, you know, with all those yellow uniforms running around there, and those gold hats flying into the dirt. It's funny. It was nice to see one guy take a head first slide, and he had an interesting pastel suit then for that minute on. He just shoomf right in, you know. I can imagine Charlie Finley running, "Hey, that's $17 cleaning bill, one of them suits. What do you think those gold things clean for?" And the Yankees, of course, looked great in their gray their gray traveling uniforms. They looked like the Yankees, fiendish. They did not need Blue Devils on the back to convince anybody after a couple of those belted triples. Well, now, this is part of our whole packaging world. We believe in packaging fun today. You know, we don't believe in having fun. We believe in packaging it, which is a very different thing. It can be embodied in, it can be shown. Have you watched any of those television commercials recently, the beer commercials? Well, have you seen those wild, insane moments of fun these people are having? The singer comes, "Wonderful day, they're having a wonderful day." And these people are playing this kid game, like tug of war, or one of those exciting games like sack race. And they're all going, "Oh, Eddie, no, stop it, Ed. No, I was pointing to the other one. That's all right. No, it's too late. When I go like that, that means that. It's too late." It's all right, Ed. See, you and Walt don't exchange signals enough when you leave. You talk about the weather and the log, the show. Come on. But nevertheless, that, to me, is an example of the kind of package whoopee which the Kansas City Athletics represent. I hope, since the Mets are obviously a very exciting but very I'm going to go on hand and predict this, that the Mets are going to be a lot better ball club than most of the writers say they are. I suspect the Mets, yes, really, they're a fine ball club, and for what they, yes, they are. Of course, New York is an interesting town. I say New York measures a team entirely by the won and lost record. To them, that's what makes a good ball club. If it won, and give you an example of that, in 1959, when the Yankees won the pennant, they were a bunch of bums. They wanted to fire everybody. One of my nutty friends is a Yankee fan. He wanted to get rid of Mantle right then. "Clean out that whole bunch of bums with a rotten team. Second-rate us. We face second-rate team." The next year, the same team won the pennant by 45 runs, 45 games. They're off and running. You should have heard of them. It's like he's completely forgotten 59. You know, the same clowns. Now they're great. He says, "You got to hand it to the Yankees, the greatest team. Absolutely the greatest team in the history of baseball. You can't deny it. Look at Mantle." Well, I says, "Al, you were the guy that all last season wanted to trade Mickey Mantle off. The Mantle fans, you know, the Mantle people for years, one of the standard traditions out at Yankee Stadium was to boo Mickey Mantle. How many of you nutty people remember that?" "Few of you. I know you do. But I've got a memory. I used to go out. I went out with Shel Silverstein in 1959. My buddy Shel, a real ball fan, see. And we go out there, and the Yankees are playing the White Sox. Well, it was one of those fluky years when the White Sox won the pennant. You know, they just did it. But the White Sox were out there playing the Yankees, and Mantle comes up. Well, this is what ensued. The Yankees are behind 2-1. It's now in the eighth inning. Mantle had gotten two of the three hits that the Yankees had gotten. Apparently, the fans were mad because Mantle hadn't hit any out of the park yet. That was what he hadn't done. So here's what happened. Mantle comes up to the plate, and you hear... Well, Silverstein looks at me, and I look at Silverstein. I said, what are they booing about? And Silverstein says, I don't know. Well, Mantle misses the first pitch. And the whole crowd is yelling at Mantle. Mantle is paying no attention. Finally, Mantle pops up, and the crowd en masse stood to its feet as he came in, trotting into the dugout. Well, I look at Shell, and I say, Shell, for crying out loud, he's the best ball player they've had since Babe Ruth. And Shell says, forget it. They're not ball fans. They're Yankee fans. They ain't winning. Kill them. Well, now, that's the way we feel about the Mets, unfortunately. It's a funny world. And I think one day the whole world is going to be taken over by Yankee fans. I don't know what would happen. Hey, you Yankee fans, what would happen if in the other nine cities of the league, they were like you guys? Do you realize what would happen? The Senators have not won a pennant in 40 years. Do you realize what would happen in Washington? There just wouldn't be a ball team, that's all. You know. The White Sox won a pennant in 59. It was the first one they'd won since 1919. There were entire generations of White Sox fans who grew to maturity and died and never saw the White Sox higher than fourth place. That was the one big year when Appling hit 388. And that they talked about that for 20 years afterwards, the time we got in the first division. Well, I don't know. You see, because that's another story. It's a very complicated problem because New York is that way. New York cannot tolerate it because it has a losing hockey team. Doesn't know what to make of that. Oh, absolutely. It just doesn't know what to make of this. By definition, it should be a winning team. It's New York. And it's New York. What is it? Toronto. Have you ever been to Toronto? It's a dead town. Come to Toronto. What are you in Toronto, Maple Leaf? Nothing town. And so we can't even support a basketball team because it's losing. Oh, yeah. Be careful. We have no room for losers in this town. So I would predict another thing. Within 5 years, the Mets will be a winning ball club or they will be in San Diego. New York will not tolerate it. Believe me. It will not make that scene. And they just better get on the stick. In fact, if they're not in the first division by next year, forget it. You're going to see acres of empty seats in that new Shea Stadium. You'll be able to open a bowling alley out there, and they won't even know you're doing it. Right out there in the left center field. And have daylight bowling and not bother anybody. That's just the way the Yankee and the New York fans are in general. Everybody is moaning. Everybody is moaning and groaning, you know, why did the Giants, why did the Dodgers leave New York? Oh, boy, why? I went out to see the Giants the last... Do you know that the Giants, the last year they were here, drew less? And they were a hot team, believe me. These guys were pennant contenders with Mays and all the rest of them. They drew less than the Mets drew last year? Really? I went out to the Polo Grounds one day to see Willie Mays and that whole crowd play. And it was sad. I got out there, and, you know, I felt like I was intruding. You know, I felt like they were having a private practice out there. And you should have heard the crying when they left town. The crying was not among fans. It was among sports writers who loved all that freeloading, you know, that you get out there at the Polo Grounds with the Giants. You know, they love that traveling around and going down to Fort Lauderdale and getting put up and all that. You know, what are you going to do? You know, obviously, there's going to be half the number of guys go out of town when two ball teams leave you just can't, that terrible production there. Well, of course, the same thing was happening at the Dodger Field. You just couldn't do it. You couldn't make the scene. But that's New York. It's just the way we are. We're terrible. We were just wild front runners. And I would be willing to bet that within a couple of years, of course there is a distinct group of people in New York that's grown up in the last 5 years that might be called freewheeling masochists. This is a great rabble horde. They wherever there is a loser, they identify with it. As long as they themselves aren't losers. Now it's like a really profound New York Post reader. You know, who's got a nice job, he's making dough, and he's doing pretty good, but he really gets mad about what's going on in Mobile. It's this kind of vicarious identification with the losers. As long as you aren't yourself a loser, you know, it's a very different kind of thing. If you're a loser yourself, then you're not really an identity. Then you get mad. That's another story. I remember going out to the Mets ballpark late in the season last year when the Mets were about 49 games out of first, you know, and dropping steadily like the bottom had fallen out. And it was all filled with thin girls, you know, the kind you can just see carrying peace signs, the kind that are all involved in the living theater and all that sort of thing. And they got the Harlequin glasses and they're carrying the whole bit, you know. And they're all sitting out there and angrily watching the Mets drop another one. But afraid any minute now they're liable to bust out with 15 runs in the seventh inning, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know what's going to happen. I suspect that if the Mets, on the other hand, thinking about it, if the Mets ever got into a prolonged winning streak, I believe they would lose a lot of their regular fans. Because I can hear them down in the village already saying, "Oh, the Mets are gone commercial, just like the Yankees." excuse me for laughing at my own gag. But I can see it happening. I really can. All up and down the line. But I'm waiting for the day, though, when I think the next team that's going to go in for the fancy uniforms, let's see, I'll make a prediction, will probably be the Milwaukee Braves. I suspect you're liable to see sateen uniforms on the Milwaukee Braves, red, white, and blue. And, red, white, and blue, and they're going to have red, white, and blue caps with stars, white stars around the back. You know, those are jazzy softball-type uniforms. And they're going to play all their games at night, and the uniforms are going to shine in the dark. I'll never forget the one time the Cincinnati Reds tried it. Did you know that? Did you know the Cincinnati Reds got sateen, but they didn't change the color, see? They had white jumpers, and they had red short-sleeved undershirts, you see, and they were done in sateen. They zipped all the way up. And one day, Ted Kluszewski, who weighed 240 pounds and was like a gigantic human bull, came sliding on his stomach into second base. The zipper worked. From one end to the other, Kluszewski got up, and he was the nakedest ball player you've ever seen in your life. Well, of course, and it goes... 3 days later, they were back in their same old wool flannel suits, and the Reds went on to win the pennant.
WOR Radio, your...